Hey everyone, welcome to the Peter Attia Drive. I'm your host, Peter Attia. The drive is a result of my hunger for optimizing performance, health, longevity, critical thinking, along with a few other obsessions along the way. I've spent the last several years working with some of the most successful, top-performing individuals in the world, and this podcast is my attempt to synthesize what I've learned along the way to help you live a higher quality, more fulfilling life. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find more information on today's episode and other topics at peterattiamd.com. Welcome to the bonus episode of The Drive. My guest for this episode is my dear friend, Dr. Paul Conti, who is not only the most brilliant psychiatrist I've ever met, but also one of the most amazing Formula One fans. Paul and I, on this relatively short episode, at least short for the metrics of this podcast, we just go on and talk about all of our favorite things in Formula One, but primarily we talk about the history of Formula One and who are the, you know, the drivers that we've loved the most. And of course, one of the things that we discuss in this podcast is that Paul and I have a number of things in common, not the least of which is our birthday, but our love for Ayrton Senna. And so we talk at length about Senna. And I think some of you who might be thinking, well, I'm not really that interested in Formula One or driving, I still think you'll find a lot interesting, because one of the things that Paul does in this episode is he ties into this discussion of the great Formula One drivers, a lot of the psychological component of what made them great and what draws us to them. I will say that, well, as I've talked about before, one of my sons named after Ayrton Senna. And I remember when I suggested to my wife that we should name our son after Senna, her first thought was, who? And then her second thought was, what? But over about 6 months of this pregnancy, as she got to learn more and more about Senna, she was kind enough to humor me as I exposed her to Senna and his greatness. She not only came around, but really not only fell in love with the name, but fell in love with the idea of Senna and the man that he was. So not that we have any expectation that our son will go on to be a race car driver, but needless to say, little Ayrton is a special little guy, and he's named after someone that I've looked up to and hold in a very high regard. And so I think in this episode, we get into some of why that's the case, and also some of the other just luminaries of this sport. So you won't probably learn more about the relevance of Formula One in a shorter period of time than you will in this podcast. And again, even if you're not interested in driving, I really encourage you to listen to this, because it will likely spark some interest. And I think the show notes have some amazing links to things that if anybody gets an itch scratched by this, they're going to dig a little bit further. So with that, welcome to the first, what I would call, bonus episode of The Drive, where Paul Conti and I spend a little bit of time going deep on our favorite topic outside of living better and living longer. So, Paul, we have a lot of things in common, not the least of which is our birthday. We share the same birthday. Which is great, because you're one of the few people whose birthdays I remember. I'm like a moron when it comes to birthdays. I have like an encyclopedic memory of many things except for birthdays. But of course, every time I wake up, usually you're calling me to wish me a happy birthday, which is reminding me that it's my birthday. Yes. I usually wake up to a text from you. The other thing we have in common is I think what can only be described as an obsession with,
yes,
arguably, though I would say it's not arguably, definitively the greatest driver in the history of driving. I remember it was one of the first things we bonded over, yes, when we got to medical school, because at that point it had only been 3 years since Senna's death.
Uh-huh.
And
amazing.
For those of us who you know, amazing, cherished him, it's a day that all of us remember, you know, Sunday, May 1st, 1994. What is it about Senna that you loved so much?
I'll try not to be long-winded, but to answer both facets of that. On the one hand, I'm not sure that I'm aware of anyone, certainly not in a way that I observed and experienced with interest as it unfolded, right? Who has been more single-minded about achievement. You know, this is a person who did absolutely everything that was required for not just the highest level of achievement, but for moving that bar of what the highest level of achievement means. And for people who don't follow, like, what Formula One was then, is this is not like somebody sitting in a car and just driving it around, right? The physical stamina, you know, the training, the ability to control oneself physically and mentally, right? The ability to hone reflexes and to multitask in ways that push executive function, push mind and body to the very limits. I've never seen anyone do that. And that's complemented by his incredibly intense passion. I mean, this is someone who, yes, was very religious, but that religiosity, I believe, was expressed in passion for people who were suffering in his home country, right? He was Brazilian, and you know, he was born wealthy, born privileged, yet had such a sense for the struggle of people who were up against things that he wasn't up against. And I believe that that unity with people who didn't have, you know, even one billionth of the things that he had, into money, fame, adulation. But I don't believe that he felt any different. I believe he felt fortunate, and he felt a sense of almost messianic drive to be the best and make things better for people. And that leads to the second facet, which is ultimately that was his undoing. He died in the context of that drive, right? Of that inability to step back from the brink even a little bit. So I think that he's a model for the best in us, and also that we can have so many good qualities and ultimately be the architects of our own downfall by not being able to step back and realize our own humanity. Like, he didn't think he was better than anyone else, but there was another level in which I think he believed, because of it was so incumbent upon him to make things better for everyone else, that he had to be superhuman, right? I mean, it's a way of not feeling better than everyone else in an arrogant way, but feeling better in a way that isolates us and means that there's always more to do and we never get to rest.
Right. There was more responsibility on him. He felt, I get the sense, of course, never having never met him, but just having read everything that one could read about him and watching every video and documentary, he felt the weight of a nation on his shoulders.
Exactly. Yes. And if you feel the weight of a nation on your shoulders, and you know, you don't realize that that just has to be a shared responsibility, right, but you take that all on yourself, then you can inadvertently be the architect of, you know, of your own demise.
I don't think many people realized until after his death how much he gave back to Brazil.
He kept a lot of that secret.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of education for, you know, underprivileged children in the, you know, in the inland part of Brazil. I mean, so it's just one example of so much of what he did was so humble, you know, and I mean, it's very interesting, you know, Sid Watkins, right, who was the great,
the neurosurgeon, that,
right, who also was by the greatest understanding of the personalities of these incredibly driven people, you know, just described a serene humility in him, that this was someone who lived an unobtrusive life when left to his own devices to live it. And you put him on camera, you could say, okay, look, here's lifestyles of the rich and famous. That's not who he was inside. And it's fascinating to know that amidst that peace and tranquility was such a desperation to do things that were superhuman. And there's a lesson in that, right? A lesson that goes back to mythology, right? Of flying too close to the sun, right? And it is a lesson for people who, I think, have great abilities and great perseverance and great ability to torment themselves in order to continue to persevere, that if we don't recognize our limits, we run great risk of not achieving our goals. And an Ayrton Senna who lived to be 90 could have done what? How much for Brazil? How much for the world? So I see him as really amongst the greatest of us for his capability, his drive, his compassion, his just living in shared humanity. But I also see him as emblematic of the foibles that are, you know, not just foibles, the dangers that we can represent to ourselves, and the need for not just humility about ourselves, but also for compassion about ourselves. And like, look, there's a limit, and we got to take care of ourselves if we're going to, you know, if we're going to keep going for ourselves and for whatever it is that we care about.
Virtually every Formula One driver today, so you look at the heroes of today, Lewis Hamilton, Sebastian Vettel, Ricardo, all of these guys, if asked, almost without exception to a man, they'll all say the same thing, that Senna's death has been the single most important change in Formula One. It was the turning point in the safety of that sport. Do you remember what they found in his car when he died at Imola? Do you remember with a flag what he had?
They found that the Austrian flag.
Which is unusual. Why would a Brazilian have been carrying the Austrian flag on the day he died?
A person who's like every cell was about Brazil had an Austrian flag. And of course we know that the day before that Roland Ratzenberger, who was Austrian, had died in a Formula One car. And how shocking and distressing that was to Ayrton Senna. And his drive to win that race. Why? I mean, everything he wanted to win was to be the best and to glorify Brazil, right? Here it was about, I think, such an intense compassion for this person's loss of life that I think it blinded him to the limits, to even his own limits. I mean, even, you know, he had limits, right? We all have limits. And I think it blinded him to those limits. And I think subsequently, it's just my opinion, it's blinded Formula One to, in a sense, the need for some element of danger to allow people to distinguish themselves. And, you know, that might sound like an odd thing to say is coming from the perspective of preserving life, right? But I think that, you know, there were times when that sport was way too dangerous and just way too many people lost their lives. But to go so far to uniformatize it and to try and eliminate danger. Some of what has been eliminated was, you know, the limits of human ambition and human bravery that I think were an important part of distinguishing people who really were heroes. And in part, they were heroes because they were taking some risks. And again, I'm not a fan of let's bring back, you know, 25 or 30% of Formula One drivers are dying behind the wheel. I mean, obviously that's not okay. But there's been such a push in the other direction. And I think that there was just really a terror in the sport. It was a terror that then sought to eliminate, you know, the opportunity to push oneself too far. But I think in doing so, there's an arena of human endeavor that can be tremendously inspiring that I think was changed too much. And I think, you know, people don't have as much, they don't have the opportunity to be Ayrton Senna, right? And I think in some ways, in order to have the opportunity to be him, there has to be the opportunity to take the risks that he took and hopefully to learn from his example and take them in a way that results in excellence and survival. But I think the sport in many ways has taken away that ability. And I think part of why people hearken back to that is it was a turning point that really changed the sport, I think, in a way, in too many ways.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. That era just seems remarkable. I mean, when you think about the rivalries that existed, you know, Mansell and Piquet and Prost and Senna, it was, I don't know, it's hard to say. I mean, like, I could talk about Formula One forever.
I think you and I actually have done this.
But there really is something about the sort of the mid-80s to mid-90s that was kind of a remarkable year. I mean, again, not that it's about the championships, because many people will still look at Gilles Villeneuve having never won a championship as one of the greatest drivers ever.
Sure.
And we could park that for a moment on the side. But I really do. So first of all, even though Senna won only, quote-unquote, three championships, in my mind, he won four.
Mm-hmm.
So the disqualification in the Japanese Grand Prix, I look at that disqualification the same way I look at the Hagler-Leonard fight, which is just, they made a bad call. There is no way he should have been disqualified in that. And so he died as a four-time champion. But if you do the math on it, you realize that the season he died, which was the third race of the 1994 season, even though the Williams car was a fraction of what it was the year before, what most people don't realize is Hill went on, his teammate, Damon Hill, went on to finish second to Schumacher that season by a point, basically. It came down to the last race. I don't think there's anybody on the world that would argue Damon Hill was half the driver of Senna, which tells you that a lot of the kinks that were going on in the Williams car of that year were getting worked out.
Yeah.
In other words, had Senna not died, I'm positive he would have been the 1994 world champion. And I suspect he would have been the world champion all the way till about 97. Because you ultimately had Jacques Villeneuve won in 97, Damon Hill won in 96, all in the Williams car.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this is, so people talk about, well, okay, you know, many years later, Schumacher went on to win so many championships, and that's impressive. I think most people still consider Senna the greatest driver of all time, but, you know, Senna could have won 7 world championships in an era when that was unheard of.
Right. I mean, you have to look at any achievement by era, yeah. Right? I mean, think about Fangio won 5 world championships in a time when most people like didn't survive 5 seasons,
exactly.
Right?
You couldn't live.
So how can you compare that to a time when safety was at such a height and the Ferrari was a dominant car? I mean, like, you know, you can't, there's a comparison then that truly is apples and oranges. And that era of like mid-80s to mid-90s, you know, was an era of like incredibly fast machines, and machines that weren't always on parity, but machines that were on parity enough that the driver could make the difference. And you really saw like what I think of as titanic struggles between exceptional personalities. So the same thing that drew me to, you know, the interest in, you know, the people behind the Second World War, to an interest in like in people who are struggling, whether it's with glory or with no one watching, right, is the same thing that to me was the attraction of Formula One, that, you know, you had titanic personalities of Prost, Mansell, Senna. And I think that, you know, it's interesting that Damon Hill won the championship that year. And again, I think that the vast majority of people would say he was not the caliber of driver of Mansell, Prost, or Senna. But look at the caliber of human being. I mean, here's a person who grew up with this incredibly dashing, debonair father, right? And, you know, you see
and
pictures.
And he was around the paddock as an infant.
Right. And when you see pictures, you know, you see Damon Hill wasn't cut in the mold of his father, right? He's probably cut more in the mold of his mother. You know, you see these pictures of him kind of standing close to his mother, looking in awe at his father.
Yeah, who just looked like a movie star.
Right. I mean, right. So he's got the handlebar mustache and he's a rower, and just he was such a, you know, a model of what it meant to be a man in that era, right? And despite not naturally having those characteristics, I think physically or personality-wise, Damon Hill won the world championship anyway. And like he went back in that Williams after Senna was killed. You know, I think that, you know, Damon Hill's story is a much quieter story, but I think it's a tremendous story of being an exceptional human. And I think that's what appeals to people who really, you know, love that era of the sport is, I mean, you and I love, we're infinitely infatuated by exceptional people. We want to understand them. We want to learn from them. In some ways, we want to venerate them. And I think there's something that's really, there's something that's good about that. But, you know, it kind of maybe drawing all this together, you know, there's also something in us that I think at times wants to idealize them. And then therefore, in a sense, idealize what we're doing. You know, and the truth is that, you know, Senna's death was avoidable. And I don't mean it was avoidable because they could have made that track dumbed down. It was avoidable if he had driven less fast, I think.
You know, I don't know that, I don't remember you and I have really ever talked about this in great detail. I mean, I have a pretty strong point of view on why he died. I'd be curious to know yours. So I think the official answer that came out of the trial was that basically the crash on the first lap that led to the safety car coming out allowed the tires to cool, and he basically lost traction. Now, there are a couple of really interesting videos on YouTube that have tried to dissect this in 10 different ways, but I got to tell you, the theory that I find most compelling, I actually think the steering column broke before he went off the road.
Okay.
So I actually think, because as you know, Senna modified the steering column in his car. So he had like an extra 6 inches of a steering column in there, and it was well, so there, he had a separate point of weakness in his steering column, and I actually think it broke. And I say that because when you look at the film of the onboard of him going off, just before it cuts out, you can see him violently turning the wheel with no effect.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But this is before the impact. So there's no dispute that the steering column broke. That's a given. The question is, did it break before or after the collision? And if it broke before the collision, it's hard to argue that that's not the single most important part of why he crashed. What's your thought?
Again, what do I know?
Like, yeah, yeah.
I
mean, you and I, we're two knuckleheads.
We're fans. Yeah, right? Yeah, we're knucklehead fans offering our amateur opinion. But my read of that is different, right? And again, who knows? But, you know, think about the Williams before that year. The active suspension, right?
Generally like regarded as the single most technologically advanced Formula One car in the history of the sport, including up until this day, even though that was 25 years ago.
I mean, you could do one little thing to like put it a tiny bit off balance and the car adjusts. I mean, that car was was like science fiction in terms of its sophistication. And sure, all the teams were trying to do that, but Williams had
Williams took it to another level.
So then, okay, what happens is they say, like, take all that stuff away. And I think through no fault of the Williams or the team, that car was a beast without that, right?
Because
it was built, right? So it was undrivable. And I think, and some of the things, you know, that Damon Hill said about driving were really scary. Like, that car was on a knife edge, and like, it was a terrifying car to drive.
Yeah, Senna did not finish the first two races of the 94 season, even though he was leading both, because he just lost control of the car. And when you watch those spinouts, you're like, that's the type of spinout I would do in a car. Like, that's not something that the world's best driver would do.
Right, right. Which I think means that, like, most people would say, okay, look, if I'm going to drive this car, because again, we're talking about a level of talent and bravery that I cannot imagine, right? That, okay, they're going to drive it and they're going to try and drive it fast. But that's a different thing than driving it on the absolute edge. Villeneuve style was, how do you know where the limit is? You go over it and you fly off the track and then you figure that out. Like, that was not the way to drive that car and survive. And I think that he knew that. But I think he forgot that when Ratzenberger died. And I think that that was the cause of the
So you accident. Think he went around that corner just a little too quickly?
I do.
Given the tire speed, basically given the tire temperature. Is that what you think it came down to?
Right. I think given all the complex factors, right, including tire temperature, all the things that had happened, I think he went too fast. And I think that there was sort of the hubris of brilliance and the need to make something right. That, you know, to win that race, I mean, imagine Ayrton Senna, had he won that race, and then he drives around the track
with an Austrian flag.
I mean, I am not sure that a human being can be glorified more. I mean, you know, think about at that point, you know, I mean, Senna had a superhuman status. I mean, there were people in lots of places, not just in Brazil, that actually felt like maybe he's immortal.
If the Brazilians loved him the most, I think you'd have to make the case that the Japanese loved him the second most, right?
Absolutely.
He was a god in Japan.
Absolutely. I mean, as you see those pictures and he's like getting off a plane, people like fainting and, you know, things that, okay, we like saw with the Beatles, but, you know, but there was a lot of like hysteria and, you know, around. I'm not trying to say anything negative about people fainting when the Beatles got off the plane, but this was like an adulation of a single human being. For his tenacity, you know, his ability to say, like, there's never enough that's been put into succeeding. So imagine him and the glory that, you know, that he would have brought. Now, again, you could say, well, what's the glory? I mean, you know, does Roland Ratzenberger need the glory, right? But it is meaningful. I mean, I think it would have been meaningful in a way of that no one would have ever forgotten, and that would have meant something to his family and his friends, and would have meant something forever. I mean, that could have been potentially one of the most memorable moments, if not the most memorable moment in the history of the sport. And I think he was so driven to do that, that he attempted to do something that was superhuman. And I think that cost him his life.
You know, there's so many things about that day that just blow my mind. Obviously, there are interviews of him on that day that he died in the paddock, and he was not himself.
And Sid Watkins has said that,
Sid
right?
Watkins
who knew him
so
well.
Yeah, he even tried to talk him into retiring.
Yeah, exactly.
He said, you know, Ayrton, you've done it all. You have nothing left to prove. And Sid, more than anybody else, knew the dangers of the sport and thought, why take one more chance?
And I think he was also afraid that not only is Senna going to take one more chance, but he's going to take
a heroic chance.
Right, exactly. And I think that's what frightened him, is he realized, like, this man is heading towards death.
You know, it's interesting when you think about Jackie Stewart's last race was a non-race.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't race his last race because his teammate, Jacques Rent was his teammate.
Sever.
Sever was his teammate, died in qualifying for that race. What was it? Was it Watkins?
It was Watkins Glen.
I mean, I love watching interviews of Jackie Stewart talking about that. And he was just like, that was enough. That was it. It was over.
Yep. And again, I don't know. I would give anything to like sit down and ask the question of Jackie Stewart, right? But, you know, here's a man who like started driving when, I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, I think there was a 30% survival rate. Like a 70% death rate, right? Of when he started driving cars, and he was so brave. Like, he worked to make safety better, but my God, who wouldn't when 7 out of 10 people aren't surviving? So he was, you know, incredibly brave, and I don't think that changed. I don't think his bravery changed. I think he had a sense of being paternal to Sever. Sever was younger. Jackie Stewart was nurturing him, and I think his sense
Jackie
of enough.
Jackie Stewart loved, I mean, he right, was, he, loved so, he wanted to give him every piece of knowledge he had.
Yeah.
is sort of the impression I get.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a different story there too, right? Which is like, how can we parse out the bravery of Jackie Stewart versus Ayrton Senna? I mean, come on, we're stratospheric. And one of them was a death. Ratzenberger's death, I think, told Senna a lesson that I believe is born of trauma. I mean, I think that, think about the drive in Senna, and it was a drive. There had to be something in him of fighting some sense of not being good enough that he had to save his country, save the world. And I think that that had fatal consequences, as opposed to Jackie Stewart, who I think he seemingly is a more balanced human being, right? Who recognized in the death of Sever, like, it's time for me to stop. And I think the different lessons from that death are indicative of, I think, the different character structures of those two men. And again, I have no basis for saying that other than being a fan of the sport and reading things and trying and thinking about it. And I mean, there was clearly something, there was a demon inside of Senna, right? I mean, I just don't think people flog themselves like that. You know, people don't just run in the heat with their uniform and helmet on, you know, until they like fall over, and then someone like, okay, at that moment you can't go any farther, someone puts you in a car and you go back and get rehydrated. I mean, like, you know, there was a way in which there was something messianic in him, and I'm not sure that there can be messianic.
Do you remember the Brazilian Grand Prix that he won in, was it 93, when his
The steering.
He got stuck in basically like,
oh, the gear, that's right.
What year was that?
I don't remember what year it was, but it was the gear. He was stuck in a certain gear.
He was stuck
gear.
In like sixth gear, something ridiculous. It was a gear that I remember thinking, I was actually thinking about this the other day. I was like literally driving around the other day, and I thought, what would I do if my car was stuck in fourth? Like, if this was the only gear I could be in, I don't even know how I would drive. And yet this guy manages to win the Brazilian Grand Prix when for a third of the race, he's stuck in some high gear.
Right. And I think, whether it was that that made the car harder to drive, but like, you know, he had muscle cramping, right, from head to toe. And I think part of it was the heat, yeah, and the extra difficulty of, you know, of yanking that car around the track, right? It made it so difficult to drive that I'm sure he understood, like, how do you keep the revs up? How do you actually do this?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, in a way that, like, again, you or I would get passed by bicycles, right?
Right, right.
But he's still able.
No, I would have
able,
just stalled. I mean, I wouldn't have been driving.
Right. And I think the drive, I mean, in my view of human performance in a way that we can witness, right? Human tenacity in a way that we can witness.
They had to pull him out of the car.
Yeah.
And when you see footage of that film, you've never seen him in that kind of pain.
No.
He couldn't hold up the trophy at the end. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
this is in front of Brazil.
Right. And he said something to, I forget, his mother and father, right, about like not to touch him.
That's right. His father was trying to hug him after the race, and he just said, no, don't touch me, don't touch me.
Pain.
Yeah.
Right? And you know, that to me is the kind of bravery that we at times don't get to witness, right? It's a kind of bravery that's like legendary in wartime, right? It's a kind of bravery that I think we respect so infinitely, and I don't think we get to see it. You know, I mean, I've talked, and this is not the time to go into it, but, you know, of an uncle of mine who's a war hero, right, who, you know, when they were shooting at him, jumped out and went and got the guy who'd been shot, right, and was decorated and, like, did things that, to me, are, like, unimaginable. Like, how do you do that? And I don't think that we know what to make of that. Like, we've been fortunate not to be in those situations, right? So we don't know, like, what would I do? Could I do that? Would I do that? And we don't have a metric for that in a way that we can understand, because we know we don't understand, like, how it's in a trench and you're being shot at and somebody's been shot and they're screaming. And, like, you know, that's, I think that's unfathomable. But I think things like Senna's achievement in Brazil and Senna's drive, like internal drive in San Marino, gives us some insight into, like, what, you know, the human tenacity under incredible, unimaginable pressures. And I think that there are ways in which it resonates with us because we get to witness that in a way that otherwise it's inaccessible to us. And we get to see it not just in its glory, but also in its fear and its terror and, you know, in the reality of it, right? That, you know, for every person who jumps out of a trench and saves somebody and gets a medal, you know, how many people are there who jump out of a trench and are dead? So I think witnessing that provides a metric in some ways of what human beings can do. And I think it's great for us to appreciate and to even venerate that. But I think the danger isn't identifying with it too much, because I think it's one thing to do that in wartime, and maybe people do that who who don't have trauma as a motivator. It's different, right? But I think doing the things that Senna did, and ultimately the things that led to his death, I see that in rooting in some demon, something traumatic. And again, I obviously don't know what that is, but something inside of him that couldn't be good enough through what he had achieved, couldn't be good enough by celebrating Roland Ratzenberger, even if he finished second or third. There was a drive in him that went against rationality and went against survival instincts. And I think that there's, you know, part of the reason I'm so interested in him is there's a lot of warnings in there to us too. And again, not to sound like a broken record, but I think so much of that comes down to trauma. And my guess is that, sure, traumatic things happen to people, but you look at the things, you know, Jackie Stewart was caught in a car, you know, stuck, and there's gasoline and it could blow up at any time. I mean, like, that man went through traumatic things. But I think ultimately, you know, his decisions don't seem to me to be made through the lens of something traumatic, and I think Senna's do. And again, that may be me trying to over-apply my heuristic, right? But that's, you know, for what it's worth, that's how I see it.
You know, hopefully there's someone still listening to this who wasn't necessarily interested in racing, but who will become. You know, I feel like there's so many things I want to link to. I mean, for me, the two best, there's like 100 videos and documentaries on Formula One that I love, but the two that stand out the most to me are, first and foremost, Senna.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the second is One. The number one, yeah. Which is actually the very first time I saw that was with you.
Yeah,
you and I watched it. You and I watched that together, yeah, like 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah. It was late on a Saturday night, and I don't know what made us decide like we're going to stay up late and watch this. But my God, you know what's interesting? I don't remember if they show it in either of those documentaries. They certainly don't show it in One, and I don't even know if it comes up in Senna. But do they show the Donington first lap?
I don't think so. In the rain at Donington.
Yeah. I mean, it's generally regarded as one of the greatest laps in the history of Formula One.
I mean, we've looked at it so much that I can't remember, like, what is it in, what isn't it in?
Either way, we'll link to it here so that people can see it. But it is, you know, it's funny, because when I first started caring about racing, I had never raced myself. So it's a totally different animal once you've actually been in one of these cars. And it completely, like, my appreciation for Senna, for anyone who does this as a profession, is 2 to 3 logarithmic orders of magnitude higher. I simply can't understand how they do it. And so especially to look at something like Donington, where you realize, like, he passed what? He passed 3 guys in 1 lap of a rainy track? And it's not 3 dudes. It's like, you know, Alain Prost. It's like, it's amazing dudes,
right? 3 of the best drivers on earth and 3 of the best cars on earth, under conditions of which it appears to be impossible to pass someone.
And you somehow managed to pass them all from number 4 position. I can watch that lap 100 times, and all I want to do is say, you couldn't make this up. If this were in a movie, you would say, that's silly. We don't do that in movies. At least draw this out over 10 laps to have some suspense. You don't get to do
it. Keep it realistic.
Yeah,
right?
Keep it realistic. This is so stupid. The other thing that fits that description is his qualifying lap at Monaco. Was it in 89 or 88?
I want to say 88.
Yeah, because it would have been in the MP44, which would have been 88.
That would have been 84, I think. The MP44.
No, MP44 was 88.
Was it? Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so then it would be 88.
So what's a normal gap in between the first, second guy in qualifying at a course the size of Monaco? Like a tenth of a second? Five 1/100ths of a second to a tenth of a second, right? Do you remember how much he was ahead of Prost that year in qualifying?
I just remember it's like, it may as well have been minutes.
Yeah,
right?
About a second and a half.
Right, like an impossible amount of time. And to someone who, look, anyone who's not impressed with that is already long stopped listening to us.
That's right. Anybody who's still listening to this, we don't have to explain why that's so significant.
So a second and a half may as well be an hour. I mean, it's an impossible gap.
And the fact that the gap was against Prost driving the same car.
Right.
And one of my favorite videos of that, because you know what's tragic? I mean, they're real tragedies. This is like little T tragic, not big T tragic. There is no onboard film of that lap.
Is that right? So the onboard film we will often see is
the onboard film we see of him is in that race,
but it's not that lap.
There, to my knowledge, and I hope somebody can prove this wrong. And if you can,
please tell us.
There's a case of Topo Chico with your name on it. I do not believe there is any onboard film from the qualifying lap in 88 Monaco in the MP44 where he goes something like 1.52 seconds faster.
I didn't realize that. I thought some of the video that we'll watch of like Senna's greatest lap in Monaco was that lap. So I think they're
from the race or other qualifying, lap. But what there is a video of is Prost's face in the paddock as he sees the time.
Shit.
And it's just a look of, are you freaking kidding
right.
me?
Right.
This guy is not for real.
Right, right. I mean, there's a man who, I think one of the greatest drivers in history, who has to have in his head like, okay, like Senna is great, but if I've gone this fast, what's the fastest he could go?
Right.
A tenth of a second more, maybe at his best, you know, 5/100. I mean, how could it, to see that, you know, it's just proof of concept of the preternatural ability of Ayrton Senna. And I think, you know, having exceptional ability at anything is a wonderful thing, but it also can be a dangerous thing. And having preternatural ability is an extremely wonderful thing and also an extremely dangerous thing.
There's a video we'll try to link to. I remember sending it to you when it came out. I described it as the finest McLaren propaganda
I have ever seen.
And McLaren has the best propaganda.
Yeah, they do. I love their propaganda.
Yeah, yeah. I'm all in. I'm a sucker for their propaganda.
I'm buying it hook, line, and sinker.
That's right. If I could have afforded a P1, I would have bought one the day that Nuremberg ring came out. I was like, I got to have one of those. But they have a video of that lap, which of course doesn't show any footage of the lap.
Yeah.
But in it, Senna says that may have been the peak of his career. Uh-huh. That moment. Yeah. He would go on. In fact, he hadn't even won a world championship yet. He won his first championship in 88. I think the MP44 was his first championship car. I think he won.
I'd have to.
Yeah, I think he won 88, 90, and 91. But anyway, to think that he believes that he was at his best even before he'd won his first championship because of that margin.
It's amazing, right? It's hubris. It's brilliance. Like it's putting together everything that's on the absolute knife edge and getting it right. Amazing.
Yeah, I remember they explained this to us, you know, in racing school, which was the difference between you and them is you will very occasionally be able to take a car to its limit. Very occasionally. And then most of the time you'll go too far and you'll lose control of the car. The best in the world are always at the limit without going over it.
It's amazing.
And so even my coach, who's a professional driver, to this day, when I sit in a car with him and we're trying to go over something, so like we'll get in the car together and I'll be in the passenger seat and he'll be in the driver's seat and we'll communicate through the radio because of course it's too loud to talk, and he'll take me through laps. So Button Willow is sort of our favorite place because it's relatively close in Southern California. There are areas there, like in particular, I don't know if you know that track well, but the bus stop, which is a part of that track.
I don't know.
To this day, I still get kind of nervous how fast he's going.
Amazing.
I'm like, how is he able to control this?
And you're
this
really good at this and really experienced and you know the car, and it's amazing you to be in the car.
I mean,
with
I wouldn't
him.
Say I'm really good. I mean, but the point is I'm not a normal, like I'm not just a lay person who's never been in or driven a race car. But yeah, it just humbles me.
It is amazing. And again, I think we celebrate and venerate exceptional talent, and I think that's wonderful, right? But I think we need to be careful about the lessons of it too. You know, that this is like one is as exciting as can be. We're talking about human beings at the limit, and it's exceptional and it's inspiring and it's risky, you know, and it really tells us something. It tells us something about human beings that we, in some ways we want to push ourselves, you know, we want to admire people who push to the limit.
So while we're on the topic of racing, there's another driver who I know a lot less about than you, but I just remember from some of our, put it this way, I remember when you figured out that I was Canadian, which was kind of a funny concept. It's like, this guy's from Canada. Like, what the hell is that?
Which, of course, Americans are secretly so jealous of Canada because you've got your shit together up there that we like make fun of you to kind of cover that up. So I think that comes from insecurity too, to be honest.
But the thing that you loved most about the fact that I was Canadian was Gilles Villeneuve.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you might be the greatest Villeneuve fan ever. What is it about Villeneuve that you loved so much?
I think part of it is like I was a kid, right? So when I first was like learning about him, you know, I was so impressionable and so impressed by the glory of utter mastery of something that was really venerated on a worldwide scale. So the fact that like there was no one with as much natural talent. I mean, one might argue, I mean, like Stefan Beloff, Fangio, Clark, I mean, Senna, you have to look, like there's only a couple people you can even talk about in the same breath in terms of natural talent. And, you know, in retrospect, I think just the utter audacity of him. You know, I mean, this is a guy who started off as like a snowmobile racer, right, in Quebec, and was so shockingly good that what a few years later he's driving in Formula One for Ferrari. I mean, like,
this was during an era when Ferrari was not a dominant car.
No, I mean, he won in a car that I think he himself described as a truck, but he was so shockingly talented. And in retrospect, I think it's interesting because, again, I think if we're going to respect and to some degree venerate humans who have great and at times preternatural talent and are willing to take risks, then we also have to acknowledge that, you know, sometimes the outcome of that is something that isn't glorious, right? That is just simply tragic. And I think, you know, Senna's death, I think, was so tragic because I think that's a person who did understand the risks. I think in many ways, Villeneuve and I think Beloff, you know, in the, how many years, almost 35 years or so that I've been, you know, really following closely, you know, high-level motorsports are two people who I mean, I'm not so sure that there was any fear in them. And that's extremely dangerous. And I think they were preternaturally.
Do you know, up until, I'm sorry to interrupt, but do you realize that Beloff's Nuremberg ring record was only broken a week ago?
I didn't know that it was broken a week ago.
Yeah.
I didn't. And again,
that's a record that stood for like 35 years or something.
And we're talking apples and oranges. I mean, in a car 35 years ago, yeah. Right? I mean, again, okay, the record was broken, but in some ways you have to look and say, like,
his drive on Nuremberg was still the most ridiculous thing ever.
Right. So the old Nürburgring, right? Yeah. The most daunting circuit.
What did Jackie Stewart call it? The green hell,
I think, is, yeah. And, you know, like, I mean, there were things that Beloff and Villeneuve did that, I mean, you truly had to, like, not have anywhere in the equation your survival, which is, you know, part of the reason neither of them survived. And again, I think it's just fascinating, the innate skill and just the utterly undaunted bravery.
Was Enzo alive when Villeneuve died, right? I mean, he was a... What did he say? He said he once said something about Villeneuve that was kind of remarkable.
Yeah, for Enzo Ferrari had been a driver, right? Mm-hmm. And it was in Tazio Nuvolari, right, that he found, like, you know, Nuvolari, it's hard to, again, compare. I mean, it was so, so long ago. But when people really talk about the greatest people that have ever, the greatest talents to ever drive a car, Nuvolari's on everybody's list. And in Nuvolari, this, like, small person, right, who didn't look like, you know, he would be the greatest driver, but who was unparalleled in his era, that Ferrari saw, like, this is the pinnacle of greatness. And it led him to realize, like, he was a very good driver, but, like, when you see Nuvolari, you kind of realize, okay, maybe I should stop driving and start building cars. And he really worshipped Nuvolari. And he said something like, who would have imagined, like, I never thought that I would see anyone, like, you know, Nuvolari died how many decades ago, that there's no one else like him. And to find the spirit of Nuvolari again in this, like, diminutive elf-like French Canadian, I mean, I think, like, was unimaginable to Enzo Ferrari, who therefore felt so passionate about Villeneuve. Because he saw in him the ultimate of talent and fearlessness and the ultimate in making a car do seemingly impossible things, which is what Nuvolari was known for and what Villeneuve was known for.
Villeneuve died in 82, correct?
1982, yeah. Zolder, Belgium.
It's a bit of a tragic story as well, not unlike Senna's death, in which you think this could have been preventable. What were the circumstances of his death? It involved a teammate, didn't it?
Yeah, his teammate was Pioni, who had a very, very different personality type. Again, I don't want to be careful not to try and go diagnosing people that I've never met or treated. But this was a person for whom ego, in the very traditional sense, was on the leading edge. Really the opposite of Villeneuve, who, you know, people describe as like devoid of guile. Like he just didn't get why, and you would never like double cross someone or do something unsavory, right? I mean, you just go out and like you went on the track. And, you know, Pironi had done things at Imola, actually, the previous
track,
race,
yeah,
that, you know, that were deceitful. I mean, either the team orders were whoever was ahead, like that's that, at a certain point in the race. And then Pironi passed Villeneuve when Villeneuve wasn't, you know, didn't think that that could happen.
His teammate would pass him. Yeah.
Right, because never in a million years would Villeneuve just like, what I'm going to do.
Disobeyed, yeah.
Yeah, and to win in a way that would then be hollow, right? Like you're in front at the time that the team has decided is when somebody wins. Now you slow down and I pass you. It's like, what's the glory in that? And I believe that he had thought that like there must have been some mistake and he like repassed Pironi, right? And then slowed down again, not even thinking then maybe he did this on purpose. And I think Pironi passed him a second time. You know, and Villeneuve's drive then was such a drive to win that at the time he was killed, I mean, it was almost like a 50-50, which direction is this car going to go? Like, you slow down so you don't take that risk that you make the wrong choice and there's disaster. And I think the absence of fear, the anger of having been deceived, in many ways the naivete really led to his death. Although by the same token, I don't think there was anyone driving with Villeneuve who like thought that he was going to retire. I don't think anyone thought that. It's like no one thought that of Beloff. Now, no one thought that of Nuvolari. And if I understand, remember correctly, he died of tuberculosis in old age, right? So that doesn't mean that they were fated, you know, to die in a car. But I think that the expectation was that there was, you know, really no concept of self-preservation.
You know, going back to Senna, one of the things that amazes me is the idea that there aren't that many examples of athletes in other sports where the greatest of the generation before and the greatest of the generation after still, without hesitation, acknowledge him as the greatest. And so there's Fangio, Juan Manuel Fangio, who, again, would certainly be on anybody's short list of greatest drivers of all time, you know, regarded Senna as the greatest. And if you ask Lewis Hamilton, who is arguably today's greatest driver, who is the greatest, without hesitation, Ayrton Senna.
Right. That's amazing.
You ask the drivers of Senna's era, who was the greatest? Ayrton Senna.
Right. I mean, I remember the interviews of Fangio as an old man,
yeah,
talking about Senna.
And he felt like this was the passing of the torch. This is the one who is better than me.
I can remember interviews, he would say over and over, lo mejor, right? He'd say like, the best. Mm-hmm. Like, this is clearly the best. And you'd see like his Fangio, you know, as an old man, almost a deity at that point,
there's
right?
A beautiful picture of Fangio standing on the podium with Senna, holding him, embracing him like a child. You know,
yeah,
the one I'm talking about?
Seen, yeah.
He has his hands on his cheeks in the most loving way.
Yeah.
It's such
yeah.
a, and again, it looks like it's his father or his grandfather.
Yeah, it's when you think about validation of someone, right? And I think that's because, you know, I mean, look, there's so many reasons for it, right? But because if you look at all around, right? I mean, again, we could split hairs about bravery, talent, and we can look at people like Villeneuve and Beloff and Fangio and Clark and, you know, and Prost, right? And Mansell and Schumacher, and you can look at all these people and, you know, there's so many different aspects of ability that you can, you know, how do you really judge one versus another without splitting hairs? But when you take it all together, there is a picture that emerges which denotes Senna as the best, right? When you combine talent, dedication, you know, understanding of the nuances, wanting to understand why the Japanese engineers, the Honda engineers loved him, because he wanted to understand every single thing about that car and the engine that was propelling it. He was the ultimate because there was nothing that was anything less than 100% intensely relevant. Every nuance of the course, every nuance of the car, every nuance of the engine, every nuance of the competition, their physical prowess, their experience, their psychological weaknesses, right? I mean, this is a person who approached Formula One like you or I might approach like saving our family, right? I mean, there's like no nuance that isn't 100% imperatively relevant. And I think to be that way and to maintain that really marked him. Like, it, you know, it elevated the talent, the bravery, it elevated everything to the really optimal level, which is why I think, you know, there's reason why the generations all say that he's the greatest, right? And I think it's for good reason. And again, I keep coming back to the idea that part of being the greatest for him was being messianic. And if you're going to be messianic, there's a risk that you won't survive it.
I remember Prost would say this in interviews. He, you know, because it's interesting, Prost and Senna had a completely tumultuous, hostile relationship until the day that he died.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. I don't remember, again, which interview I've seen it in. It might be in one of these documentaries, but Prost tells the story of how, because he had retired in 93 mm-hmm. after winning in the Williams, I guess that year would have been the 15, right? The F-15. And now he's a commentator. So uh-huh. at Imola that day, the day that Senna died, Senna said on the radio something to the effect of, "I want to welcome my great and wonderful friend, Alain Prost. It's so wonderful to have you on the radio," or something to that effect. And Prost commented how he was like so moved by that. Uh-huh. You know, they had such a bitter rivalry. And here was Senna paying him this wonderful, gracious, kind compliment. And of course, several weeks later, you know, or several, yeah, probably a week later, Prost is one of his pallbearers.
Yeah.
But Prost had said many times during interviews, he's like, the problem with Senna is he thinks he can't die.
Right.
He has this belief that he has some God-given right to win every race, no matter what.
That's messianic, right? And, you know, when you think about the personality types, right? I mean, Prost was, as far as I can ascertain, a practical man. I mean, there's a reason why his nickname was the Professor, right? Mm-hmm. Like, his goal was, I'm going to win as much as I can.
It's okay. It's probabilistic. And yeah, we played. Yeah.
I want victory. I want the fame and fortune that comes along with it. And fucking obviously, I want to survive it, right? Because, like, there's a whole bunch of things to do afterwards. And, you know, that mentality running up against a messianic meaning to, like, everything, right? To every qualifying, every practice session, and, you know, every, let alone every race, they were so different that I think it was almost impossible that they weren't going to clash in ways that became deeply personal. But when you take them out of that crucible, right, that these were people that ultimately, I think, had deep respect for the differences in them. I mean, I think in ways, maybe one might say Prost could have used a little bit of Senna and Senna could have used a little bit of Prost.
Yeah, but they were oil and water. They wouldn't mix. I mean, you know, Frank Williams, from the day he first saw Senna, always wanted him on his team. And the reason it took until 1994 was because Prost was there, and Prost had a clause in his contract that said, I will never be on the same team as Senna.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he had to wait for Prost to retire to leave McLaren.
Right. Which Frank Williams, I mean, my understanding and from what I've read is, you know, that Frank Williams loved pitting people against one another, right? I mean, I think the most exciting person I ever watched drive, I do think, is Nigel Mansell. And, you know, you look at Mansell was considered kind of second rate, right? He was, you know, at a time there were ones and twos, you know, he was the two to Andretti. And I think he was a two
to Piquet.
Still Fittipaldi.
He was the two to Piquet right?
But when Frank Williams had him as the two to Piquet, that was because, well, Piquet was the acknowledged number one,
right?
But it wasn't.
But Mansell
forbidden.
Was saying, oh God, no.
Right. And Williams wasn't the kind to say, look, you
have
are
to
number
sit
two.
In the number two.
Right. He was the kind of say, look, you're starting number two, but you want to be number one, you know.
Go out and prove it.
And part of, you know, PK's kind of denigration, I think, you know, his haughty condescension to Mansell is part of what, like, infuriated him, you know, and I think made him, you know, really among the greatest of the greats. I mean, you watch, I believe it's Mexico City, you watch Mansell pass Berger mm-hmm. on the outside. I mean, like, Mansell did impossible
yes.
things with impossible aggression. And I think Senna said at one point that they asked him, like, do you worry when you see someone in your rearview mirror? And he said the only person he worried about was Mansell because he's content to go over you if he can't go around you. I mean, that's a powerful statement coming from Senna. And part of what did that was, I think, the infuriation of being the number two to a condescending number one and wanting to trounce him.
That's why that era, I mean, my God, like, it's just unbelievable to me to go back. And I get, honestly, it sounds awful to say this, but I much prefer enjoy watching races from that era than even watching races today, which isn't to say I don't enjoy races today. And I think this year with you know, Mercedes and Ferrari both being so close, it's actually quite exciting again. Formula One has had a few years of really uninteresting racing because so much of, as you said, so much mechanical, so much of it is in the car now and less of it's in the driver. But, you know, back then you really got to see the difference.
Yeah, I think that was an era when the force of personality, and you think about the difference in personalities of Senna, Prost and Mansell, right? But are there ever stronger personalities on the face of the planet? And the force of personality could lead to seemingly impossible things. And from my perspective, that was incredibly exciting to watch. I mean, what is the limit of human potential in this arena where human potential in terms of physical stamina, you know, cognitive ability, you know, reflexes, you know, the kind of things that we most respect in people in terms of being able to do incredible things. It's incredible things in the body and the mind, and then putting those together. And then you put that together with the force of personality. And I think it gives us an insight into things that we usually don't see, you know, like the depths of human struggles in wartime. And I do really believe it's also the depth of human struggle in quiet situations that no one cares about, right? I mean, I really do believe that I think that we get an insight not just into, you know, the people who, you know, win Purple Hearts, right? But I think also the people who persevere with nobody caring, right? And no one watching them. And I think in many ways, you know, that's one of the greatest models of bravery. And it might seem like odd or weird or even forced to compare that to things that these people did on a track under, you know, the greatest crucible of bringing talent and ability and bravery to the fore. But I do see those parallels, that I think in many ways there's a lot of parallels between these people that we're talking about and people that no one knows their names, and they're struggling quietly. They're struggling quietly for, you know, the next paycheck that puts food on the table. And they're struggling amidst whatever physical or emotional pain they have. And I really do mean that. I mean, again, I'm not trying to be forced about it. I don't, may come off that way, but I think even back when I was younger, seeing this, I realized that this is like human struggle under the microscope, but it's emblematic of all sorts of human struggle that, you know, that often is inaccessible to us because it's in a place we can't go, which could be the quiet struggles of the uncelebrated as much as it could be the battlefield.
So one last driving question. I don't know if the video exists anymore on YouTube. I actually ended up just buying a copy of it because I was so enamored by it. But Rendezvous.
Yeah. Yeah.
So hopefully we'll be able to find a copy of it and link to it. But if we can't, and there's a good chance we won't be able to, I do recommend you go on Amazon and you splurge and just buy the DVD of Claude Lelouch, his very famous short film called Rendezvous, which you introduced me to when we were in medical school.
Yeah.
I hadn't actually seen this.
Well, that was like the automotive equivalent of a snuff film. Yeah. You know, I don't even know where I first saw that, but I think it was somebody who had some like VHS copy of it, or, you know, when we first were watching it together, you know, it was this like legendary, inaccessible thing.
Yeah, that you'd heard about but never seen. And I still remember we were at Pyle's house when you whipped out either the VHS or whatever, and we somehow watched it. And I mean, we probably watched it 50 times because you couldn't believe you were seeing this thing.
Yeah.
So what's your best guess? Who is the driver?
You know, I have no idea, in part because I had these guesses, but now I think the knowledge of who it was or wasn't has kind of moved ahead. So, you know, my thought that it might have been Jackie Ickx, for example. Like, again, I don't know if like that's been entirely debunked, and it clearly isn't. Depailler, I believe Depailler was still alive at the time, and you know, the thought of like, okay, who was incredibly brave?
It had to be
brave.
Someone who was an amazing driver, pretty fearless, and had to know Paris like the back of their hand.
Yeah, and also in an era that look, I think Rendezvous is like one of the most amazing things filmed, but I also, you know, there's a part of me that I don't want to sound like a school mom that wants to say, look, they clearly put other people's lives at risk, right? So like in the craziness of the 70s and in that era of like really being untamed, you know, you would need someone who would just be able to like literally throw all caution to the wind about self and other, right?
I mean, Lelouch was arrested when that film showed.
I think because the thought was that he was driving.
Yes.
Right? And it was shown.
It's made to appear that he's driving at the very end.
Because he gets out of the car.
He gets out of the car. Right. But having now watched it 87 times on slow-mo, it's clear that he's superimposed. He basically sneaks in and looks like he's getting out, but he wasn't the driver. There's no way.
Right. I mean, unless he was a closet Formula One driver, it's like, how could you be that? Like, how could you be that adept, mm-hmm. right? If you weren't like one of a handful of people, I mean, that would be my take on it. Again, maybe that's wrong, but I think that's why people started looking to, okay, who are the Formula One drivers who are like completely fearless, would throw caution to the wind and no Paris, and, you know, and then there were just kind of a handful of names. I mean, I'd love someday to know the definitive answer, but certainly watching it, again, I think that's emblematic of an era. Right, of an era when, I mean, I believe that it was the first time when like cameras could be mounted in cars, right? And you could have like stabilizing devices.
Yeah, you had gyroscopic technology that basically allowed you to stabilize that. And of course, to this day, there's still huge debate as to whether it was a Mercedes dubbed over a Ferrari, like whether the Ferrari was dubbed over the Mercedes or if it was the actual Ferrari being driven.
Right, and again, I don't know enough. I mean, I try and think about like the sound versus the visual synchrony, right? And it seems to me like I'm not so sure how that could have been dubbed, right? But yeah, again, what do I know?
Yeah, there's no dispute that the sound is that of the Ferrari, so you're right. The question is, I mean, again, this is, now we're getting so deep in baseball, it's like, but of course,
you and I are the only two listening.
At this point, it's probably safe to say there is not another person on earth that is listening. Now you and I are just talking and we happen to be recording.
Right, exactly. Exactly. If anyone wants to know how like boring, pedantic, and tedious our lives actually are, this is a perfect indicator, right? We're down to nuances of like whether the Ferrari was dubbed over the Mercedes or vice versa.
Well, with that, I think it's really great that a podcast whose title is The Drive finally gets to have an episode, albeit a relatively short one, that focuses on driving. And there's no person I enjoy talking about driving with more than you. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
And I hope that, you know, we're going to have lots of things that for anyone who managed to get through this part about driving and who finds themselves interested or wants to know more about it, we're going to link to some unbelievable videos about all of these great personalities that we've discussed. And if nothing else, hopefully it gives you some appreciation of the amazing technical skill that goes into what these guys have done.
Yeah.
You can find all of this information and more at peteratiamd.com/podcast. There you'll find the show notes, readings, and links related to this episode. You can also find my blog and the Nerd Safari at peteratiamd.com. What's a Nerd Safari, you ask? Just click on the link at the top of the site to learn more. Maybe the simplest thing to do is to sign up for my subjectively non-lame once-a-week email where I'll update you on what I've been up to, the most interesting papers I've read, and all things related to longevity, science, performance, sleep, etc. On social, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, all with the ID PeterAtiaMD, but usually Twitter is the best way to reach me to share your questions and comments. Now for the obligatory disclaimer. This podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. And note, no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to the podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnoses, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they have and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Lastly, and perhaps most importantly, I take conflicts of interest very seriously. For all of my disclosures, the companies I invest in and or advise, please visit peteratiamd.com/about.